My spear weighs heavy in my hand. Part 1. Long, distant, and long ago, and far from here, there was a man named Mastanab. He bore many burdens, and the weight of a nation rested on his shoulders. This is his testament. I looked back across the desert, and I beheld the 40,000. The dread sun beat down, drenching the sands in blinding light. The sound of the grinding wagon wheels, the bellowing camels, the weeping children, all dulled and muted by the vast emptiness of that awful expanse. Baal Amon was with us, Baal Oris was with us, but they gave no food nor water, for the gods do not take pity on the weak. I gazed into the dust cloud flung up by the thousands trudging ever on through the parched emptiness, looking for omens. An old man stepped out from the crowd. I did not know him, but I knew his intent. The old had given themselves to the sands time and again on the long march, when their will had deserted them, and their bodies had grown too weak to carry on. He looked at me, a bottomless weariness in his eyes, and I bowed. They have not surrendered. They have triumphed over their fear of death. They are fulfilling a duty to the tribe. They are dying for us. He sat in the sand, far from the dust cloud, breathing easy air, and I turned away. A death given freely is a private thing. 12 yesterday, said my father behind me, sweat dripping from his brow. And 3 so far today. We're losing people fast. He was gazing out over the 40,000, a nation on the road, everyone I had ever known, marching ever onward. How much further? I asked, knowing the answer would be the same as it had been every day for weeks. It's in the hands of the gods. We were the first to cross the desert, the first to even try. We had no choice. Enemies to our south, enemies to our east and the west, only the mountains, where the old bones lay, the bones that think and seethe and wish to be forgotten. We were refugees from a fevered war in a land that wished us ill. And on we went. Mastanab, said my father.
Yes, father.
There is to be a council tonight. All the Maseisaden are to come. You are invited. I remember being surprised and fearful. I was no elder. I was too young and too headstrong. But I was champion. I was our best warrior, the best we had left. Most of the 40,000 were women and children. Less than 6,000 were men of fighting age. We had lost our wars and our lands. We had lost everything. The day of walking past, not a day of marching, though we had started our journey with determination and hope and sung the songs of our ancestors as we forged on. No, this was a day of slouching misery. The desert had beaten us. It had crushed all hope and left us aimless and lost in the boundless, bare eternity. We walked on not because we had hope that an end was in sight, but because there was nothing else to do. Each of us, the whole of the 40,000, trudged on through that dreary endlessness. And then night came, and with it came the cold. I looked back from a high dune at 40,000 people huddled together for warmth. There were fires here and there, but most had used all their fuel days ago. Our city had been burned by the enemy, torn to the ground in their victorious slaughter. We were the ashes of a civilization, the dying breaths of a proud and ancient people. I thought about our temple, the two-headed golden statue of Balmaeus within, the cracks in the baked clay of the bricks and the billowing clouds from the incense that burned there day in and day out. I thought about the steps from the door, leading down into the square where we had made sacrifice to our patron god, and the blood of the cattle made the dusty ground red and damp as the priests chanted their hymns of praise, their gore-drenched fists reaching up to the blazing sun. And then the war had come. The enemy had always raided, always stolen our cattle and burned our villages, and we had raided in return. It was the cycle of the seasons, the dance of arrow flight and spear tip, vengeance and mercy. Some years there had been peace, as the enemy's neighbours in turn had attacked them, and some years we had forged a bloody path deep into their lands. And then this year, they had overcome us. I closed my eyes in the darkness of the desert by night and heard the children weeping and nothing else. The 40,000 sat near silent, shattered, broken, done. The meeting was like no other. The council sat at the top of a dune, under the cart with the statue of Balmaeus, around a fire fed with what little we had left to burn. Ancient tapestries and the clothes of the dead. A scrap of ox meat slowly singed over the meagre flames. There was so little left. We had water, but little food, and not even the slightest idea how much further we might need to go. I'd been asked to wait a respectful distance while the elders sang the opening rites and began their discussions. It was cold, bitterly so. I stamped my feet and retied what remained of my sandals, stomped up and down again and breathed into my hands. My robes were threadbare now. Where they had once been long and flowing, they now streamed out as tattered black rags whenever the wind caught them. I heard muttering in the distance, a whispered conversation, but could not make out the words. When a hand landed on my shoulder, I nearly jumped out of my skin. I turned to see Tamsy, her white teeth and bright eyes shining in the moonlight. "How are you doing?" she asked. Her voice sounded strangely loud in the silence. "Well enough," I said, with a pang of guilt, as I remembered that I would have been provided more food than her on our journey. "How's your family?" Her smile vanished. All I could see of my childhood friend were the whites of her eyes. "Father stepped out from the march yesterday. Gave his death for the tribe." We stood in silence. There was no hope for any of us, if even mighty Sumeron had surrendered to the desert. He had bounced me on his knee when I was an infant, and been champion of the tribe long before I was born. And now even he was gone. "I'm sorry." I'd said the words, but a part of me felt a touch of envy. His journey was over, and the pang of hunger in my belly and the rasp of thirst in my throat lingered on. "Thank you," said Tamsy. "He liked you." She was smiling again, but I could see in her eyes she was stifling tears. I tried to change the subject, but at that moment a great cry went up from the council. They were calling my name. "I have to go," I said. "Wait here, if you wish. We can speak about him." "I would like that," she said. And I walked away, her silhouette sublimed into the darkness of the desert. "Masternap," said Chief Engengel. "I'm glad you're here. We've come to a decision." I was taken aback, but said nothing. I should have spoken then. I should have railed against the choices they'd made, but I was still full of the uncertainty of youth and feared the wrath of the elders. The chief looked old in the firelight, his parched lips wrinkled and his face deeply lined. His hair had turned even whiter than before, a cloud floating over his dark face. The words he spoke were a monotone, pregnant with dread. "We shall use the glass of Balmaeus. We shall open the gate. The shamans have told us it can be done, and we shall pass through it. We have so little left, but more than enough to sustain a few for weeks, maybe months if you're careful." "But," I said, "to open it..." The silence was heavy around the campfire. It was a silence that spoke of arguments made and pondered, and laid to rest long before I was called to speak. I had not been brought here to take part. I had been brought here to take orders. "You will obey. We have no other choice." The chief has spoken, and his words were final. They always were. He was an unyielding man, and his will was our action. It took all night. We knew what had to be done, that the glass must be watered before the gate could open. It was brought to me in the cold light of the breaking dawn, a looking glass, around half my height, three handspans across, made of some strange metal. Most of the time it reflected perfectly the view around it, but when fed it would flicker and change and show us other places. It was the last gift of Xynthippe, the wanderer who had founded our tribe. It was our heart, our soul. Two of the wise women held it up, an honour for them, and a duty they performed with dignity and pride, even as their unkempt hair wafted in the morning breeze, and their fine, flowing green robes billowed in ragged tatters. They were the keepers of the glass, the only ones who had escaped as the enemy ravaged our temple. I knew I would do what was asked of me then. I knew our way of life, our people, would vanish forever if I did not. The 40,000 were forming a line, families gathered in groups, too exhausted to make any noise. The desert was silent, rolling dunes to the horizon, and a nervous excitement began to grow as the shamans walked up and down, inspecting them all. They pulled four from the crowd, though the process took hours. All were young. Their families wailed and beat their breasts and fell to their knees, begging the shamans to choose another. But they would not. The spirits of our ancestors had moved through them, and their will could not be denied. It took 36 of us to tip the cart until the yokes pointed into the clear and lightening sky. I shall never forget the wailing of the chosen, those poor youths whose blood we spilled into Xanthippe's glass, the way they struggled as we dangled them by the ankles from the carts, the way the shaman's chanting raised to a fever pitch as I raised my knife to a young man's throat, as he gurgled his last breaths and the blood dripped in pumping gobbets from the glass began to shudder and zephyrs danced around it. Did the sky darken, or did I just imagine it? Did I hear rumbling voices shouting from some unfathomable distance? No matter what I heard, the glass had changed. No longer did it perfectly reflect whatever was before it. Now it was pitch black, rippling with a shimmering, deep darkness. Blood stained the frame, and my eyes began to sting whenever I glanced in its direction. And then the tribe went into the dark. The 40,000 in a line walked one by one into the dark space behind the glass. It took hours. I do not know precisely how long, but my people walked, almost all of them, in desperation, in despair, into the unknown world beyond shadows. By the time the last of them stepped into the glass, I had moved away a little down the dune to find some solitude. I was now head of the tribe, and the tribe was now 6. The water buffalo brayed, uncomfortable in the heat and chafing at the yoke. The cart was laden with supplies, a poultry fare for 40,000, but enough to keep 6 alive for months, if we were careful. I surveyed the 6 of us left. I was glad the elders had allowed me to choose Tamsi. At that time I was in love with her, and still too inexperienced to tell her, so instead played the role of friend in the vain hope she might notice of her own accord. I did not know then that women find timidity as off-putting as they find overconfidence. I also had Gralacor, a young and headstrong warrior renowned for being a talented scout. I had Orinorta, a skilled huntress, but heavy with child and unable to hunt at this late stage of her pregnancy. I had Durere, the strong. He was older than I, but renowned for his smithing. And I had Nelsu, Durere's wife, left with us to nurse Orinorta through her birth. "We must keep going north," I said, fighting to stop my voice breaking with exhaustion and terror. "This desert has an end. Only the gods and the faithful wanderers last forever, and Baal-Amon is with us. When we reach safety, we will once again open the gate, bring our people back from the other side of the glass." I had so many questions and so few answers. The shamans had tried to tell me where they thought the glass led, but I do not believe even they truly understood what they were saying. They thought they might be safe there, and tales spoke of others who had stepped beyond and returned, and that was all they knew. Tamsi took my hand and bade me sit upon the cart, between the carcasses of the oxen we had slaughtered for their meat. At least we would eat well, and we would have water and wine to see us through. 2 days. 2 days was all it took. Gralacor saw them first. I'd assumed them to be vultures, circling something rotten in the distance, but his sight was keener than mine, and he recognised them for flamingos. As we turned our wagon and drove onward, we saw more and more of them swarming through the sky, a chaos of rippling pink. Hours later, and we were walking through grass, palm trees and desert flowers, an oasis, a paradise in the desolation. I stayed with Orinorta on the cart as the other four ran as fast as they could towards the water, flinging aside their clothes, a river running deep and fast from west to east. Orinorta laughed, and I looked at her confused. "Mastanab," she said, "you're making a face like a horse. Go, go on with you. I'll drive the water buffalo. It's not like there's anything I need protecting from around here." I grinned and passed her the reins, and leapt onto the grass to run towards the river. The joy of it. I still smile when I think of it now. We splashed thigh-deep into the cool waters, scattering fish and birds as we laughed and drank deep of that nectar. I was filled with the heady joy of salvation. Here there was food and water aplenty, enough for 40,000, enough to open the gate in the glass and fetch them back to the world. Not yet, though. Not yet. We had to rest and recover and prepare ourselves for the ritual. I looked across the emptiness and remembered the glowing watchfires of the enemy as they laid siege to our land. There had been so many of them, glowing like yellow stars in the night. Every tribe to our south, every tribe to our east had sworn themselves to one commander and come to destroy us. We had always hated them, they had always hated us, and they meant to destroy us. Our very survival was victory. And here we were, across the vast desert, out of reach of their blades. I saw Orinorta lift herself down from the cart and tether the water buffalo to a palm tree. She waddled towards us, her feet swollen this close to birth, and gingerly joined us in the water. We were safe at last. We thought our war was over. As we came out of the water and retrieved our clothes, averting our eyes from each other and giggling like children, it all began to sink in. I had lost track of the days of our flight. It had been my birthday at some point in the desert, and we had been starving, desperate and afraid. I sat in the grass, then leaned back until I rested upon the damp ground in my damp clothes and let the warmth of the sun wash over me. A low rumble, loud and animal but distant, and I opened my eyes, but I could see nothing, and I closed my eyes once again. I woke up feeling Tamsi's fingers on mine. They had all been kind enough to let me rest as they set up a camp and watered the water buffalo. They had put up the two tents we had with us in the shade of some palm trees and spread a thick layer of dry leaves on the grass within. It was a comfortable place to rest, but I had slept for hours already and volunteered to take the first watch. There was a tree close to the sandy bank of the river, and I leaned against it as the sun set. The water sparkled in the dying light, and a gentle breeze pulsed through the leaves and away across the desert behind us. I felt that night that I might never tire of that place. I could hear the creatures rustling through the grass, and the water trickling past, and the distant cries of foxes. The embers were warming the tent for the five already sleeping, and I shod my sandals to walk barefoot along the river bank. I think back now to that restful place, and to my wandering, and I shudder at my carelessness. When Dureri and Nalsu came to take over the watch, I was more than happy to curl up on the ground in the tent and embrace my sleep. I drifted off to the sounds of my companion's quiet breathing and the waters rushing by outside. The waters rush in, and I am falling through an empty void. I cannot tell which way is up, or whether I am above or under water. I know I am not alone. I can taste metal. Black shapes winnow and wisp around me. They are invisible in the darkness, but I know they're there. A sound begins to rumble. A mighty voice, a chorus, first humming, then shouting. They're saying my name. I see the 40,000. They are naked on their knees, raising their arms in adoration at a multitude of gargantuan figures in front of them. The giants shine with sacred light. It hurts to look at them. The 40,000 are wailing in abject supplication. They are at prayer. Smoke rises in the distance. There is a fire on the horizon. Their voices rise. They are wailing now in desperation. The wail becomes a scream, loud and piercing. The void shakes and I shake with it. Light pierces once more and I awake. Mastanab! Mastanab, wake up! Wake up! Tamsi's shouting tore me from my slumber and I sat up with a start. I could tell the sun had risen some while ago, and the heat in the tent was close to unbearable. "What's happening?" I murmured. "I think. I'm slow to wake at the best of times, but the screaming I could hear shook something in me, and I scrambled to throw on my tunic and belt before hurling the tent flap back and feeling my stomach lurch at the sight before me. Orinorta was lying on her back, legs apart, screaming at the sky, as Nalsu knelt before her and shouted to Gralacor and Durere for more sheepskins. "She's giving birth!" Tamsi shouted at me, noticing my baffled expression. My jaw dropped. I had no idea what I needed to do. No experience of the women's world. I should point out that Tamsi clearly had no idea what to do either. In retrospect, she had woken me in panic in the hope I may be able to somehow help. "For the love of Xynthippe, go and help!" Tamsi cried, shaking me out of my daze. Instinctively, I grabbed my spear and ran to her, and then stopped as I realised I had no idea what to do. Gralacor was cradling her head, and Durere was flinging dry sheepskins to Nalsu. I saw the discarded bloody rags beside her and my head spun. "Is she all right?" I asked, knowing how idiotic I sounded even as I said it. "I don't know. I think so. There's a lot of blood," said Nalsu. "Well, I was told to expect some. I've never done this before." "What?" Orinorta screamed and bit down on the thick branch Gralacor had given her. "It's fine," said Nalsu in a soothing, sing-song tone. "The elder women told me what to do." "I don't care about that," bellowed Orinorta. "I thought you'd done this before, you bastard!" Orinorta's voice rose to a scream and stayed there for longer than I thought possible. I took a bucket from the cart and ran to the river, gathering water for reasons I do not understand. Thinking back now, it seems clear that I was in a state of panic, adrift in a place I felt I had no business being. I should have saved my fear for later. It was also then, I think, that I heard the first rumble, though I did not know what it was, a loud, sustained bass note. And then I heard a very different noise, a sound that caused me in my impatience to heft my bucket of water in one hand and my spear in the other and sprint toward the brand new, crying person who sounded like their lungs were going to be as powerful as their mother's. Gralacor stopped me before I reached the new mother and her child. "Secret name," she said, and I felt a fool. Nobody could know the secret name of a newborn. It was something a mother whispered to them, something for them alone, never to be shared until their wedding day. "Come and take him, Gralacor," said Orinorta. "I still feel a little..." Orinorta began to scream again, just as loudly and for as long as she had before. All of us stood in silence a moment, frozen in our confusion, until Nalsu's eyes widened, and she quickly knelt once again between Orinorta's legs. "There's another one," she shouted. "It's twins!" Tamsi took the baby Orinorta had already birthed, while the rest of us panicked. Once again, we had no idea what to do, and I stood feeling limp and useless as the others rushed about me. I backed off, wandering near a pile of boulders, away from the river, trying to stay out of the way. I remember breathing deep and laughing, a great gut-shaking belly laughs at the horror of the plight of the 40,000 and the joy of knowing Orinorta was about to birth a second child into the world. And then I heard the sound, a noise like no other, primal and deep, long and loud, a sound all creatures are born knowing and born fearing. It was behind me. I was between it and the river. I saw its front paws first, each the size of my head, claws like knives, one chipped incisor in a mouth of huge teeth, a mane like the sun at sunrise. Lion. Even when the shamans had opened the gate of Balmeas, I had been less afraid than when I saw that great beast before me. I could see thick muscle move beneath that beautiful fur. I could hear the water buffalo nearby shrieking in fear. I could smell the feral scent of the wild in the massive beast before me. Its eyes were narrowed, and a blood-red tongue lolled between black lips as the cries of a new life sprung forth from Orinorta, mingled with the trickling river. I felt my spear in my hand, and knew there was no choice for me. Orinorta could not be moved now. Gralacor was weak from our journey. Nalsu had to see to Orinorta. Tamsi had never been a warrior, and Durere was nowhere to be seen. I prayed to the sun for forgiveness, and locked eyes with the monstrous thing in front of me. "Oh, Balmeas, oh, Xynthippe," I heard myself say. "Give me strength, steal my heart, give me a soul of iron and stone. The great beast was trying to circle me, to get around me and reach the scent of blood from Orinorta, but I would not let it. As it went left, I went left. As it skirted to the right, I darted in front of it and jabbed at it with my spear. It reared back, clawing at the air as I backed away slowly, careful not to trip. To trip would be the death of me. I could hear the others behind me begin to panic. Orinorta was screaming still, but now in terror instead of pain, as the second child wailed at the sky, born under a lion's glare. Durere appeared, holding a thick branch he must have picked up from the ground near the river. It was sturdy, but lacking a point. It would not be enough to take on the beast. I glanced to my left, where the glare of the sun was reflecting off the glass of Balmaeus, the gift of Xanthippe, threatening to blind me. The lion roared again, and took a step in my direction before leaping towards Durere at an astonishing speed. He cried out, swung the branch in his hands too late as the creature raked one enormous paw down his chest, scoring three great gashes and roaring in primeval fury. I took my chance as its back was turned and thrust my spear into its side. I felt the iron tip of the spear bounce off the lion's ribs, then slide deep into the beast. I saw Orinorta and Tamsi had clambered onto the cart, armed themselves as well, their spear tips weaving crazily in the air as they breathed in deep in exhaustion. Gralacor and Nelsu held the newborns behind them, and the light of the sun flashed from the glass of Balmaeus, blinding me. I do not fully remember what happened next. I remember I was no longer standing, but seeing the ground rushing along beside me, a strange pressure in my left arm crystallizing into agonizing pain as the lion bit down on it. I remember the feeling of submerging into the cool waters of the river. And then there was darkness.